ladies and gentlemen. I'm really pleased to be here. I'm really honored to have this opportunity to address this group of many friends and friendly people. It's difficult to speak after two such excellent speakers and not to repeat most of the arguments. I was especially fascinated by Professor Gisgurarson, by his knowing about the Czech writer Ivan Obracht, because it was a book we were all forced to read when we were in the primary school in the communist era, and that there is someone in Iceland who knows that book is for me almost incredible that something like that can happen. We forgot that name and that book already, but it lives in here. That's very interesting. I prepared many quotations, so I will try to make my presentation faster once the full text can get it. I prepared all the already mentioned quotations by Professor Westholm, Hayek's definition of intellectuals as the professional second-hand dealers in ideas, who are proud of not possessing special knowledge of anything in particular, who do not take direct responsibility for practical affairs, and who need not even be particularly intelligent to perform that mission. And we can continue in this respect. I hope it's well known. I was also aware of the enormous power of intellectuals to shape public opinion, and warned us that, I quote, "It's merely a question of time until the views held by the intellectuals become the governing force of politics." This is as valid today as it was when he wrote it. We speak about ideas, practical ideas, dealing with ideas. The question is, what kind of ideas is favored by the intellectuals? They are definitely not neutral in their choice of ideas with which they are ready to deal. They do not hold or try to spread all kinds of ideas. They prefer ideas which give them jobs and income, and which enhance their power and prestige. They look for ideas which enhance the role of the state, because the state is usually their main employer, sponsor, or donator. That's not all. According to Hayek, and I quote again, "The power of ideas grows in proportion to their generality, abstractness, and even vagueness." Hence, it is not surprising that intellectuals are mostly interested in abstract, not directly implementable ideas. This is the way of thinking in which they have comparative advantage. They are not good at details. They do not have ambitions to solve a problem. They are not interested in dealing with the everyday affairs of common citizens. Hayek again put it clearly, I quote, "The intellectual, by his whole disposition, is uninterested in technical details or practical difficulties." My wife would say that I'm a typical intellectual, and she's looking at me now. The intellectual is interested in visions and utopias, and because socialist thought owes its appeal largely to its visionary character, and I would add lack of realism and utopian nature, the intellectual tends to become a socialist. Quoting Hayek, many other quotations is possible. I think that Raymond Aron, in his famous essay, "The Opium of Intellectuals," made many similar points. I like, especially in this respect and in this context, very much his difference between prosaic and poetry. The socialist approach is, in the words of Aron, based, and I quote, on the poetry of the unknown, of the future, of the absolute. This is exactly the world of intellectuals. Some of us want to add that the poetry of the absolute is an inhuman poetry. As I said, the intellectuals want to increase their own prestige and power. When we, in the communist countries, came across the ideas of Hayek and Arendt 40 years ago, we had no problems to understand their importance. They gave us the much-needed explanation of the somewhat peculiar prominence of intellectuals in our society of that time. Our intellectuals, of course, didn't like to hear it and didn't want to recognize it. But the communist politicians and the rulers of the communist regime needed their intellectual fellow travelers. They needed their dealing in ideas, their shaping of public opinion, their apology of the inhuman, irrational, and inefficient regime. They needed their ability to supply them with general, abstract, and utopian ideas. They especially needed their willingness to deal with the hypothetical future instead of dealing with the very much less rosy reality. Of course, the intellectuals at that time were not happy. They were deeply disappointed with their economic well-being. They were frustrated by many constraints they had to face and follow. Their position in the communist society was nevertheless relatively high and paradoxically very prestigious. The communist rulers, in their arbitrary and voluntaristic way of dealing with people, used and misused the intellectuals and were able to make them up for it. This brought the intellectuals in a very tricky position. They were not valued or evaluated by the invisible hand of the market, but by the very visible hand of the rulers of that society. To my great regret, many intellectuals were not able or didn't want to understand the dangerous implications of such an arrangement. As a result of this, after the fall of communism in our suddenly free society, the first frustrated and openly protesting group were the intellectuals. They were protesting against the unpleasant constraints created by the market. They found out very rapidly that the free society and free markets may not need so much of their service as they were used in the past. They understood that their valuation by the impersonal forces of supply and demand may be not only less favorable than their own self-valuation, but even less favorable than that of politicians and bureaucrats of the old regime. They became, therefore, the first visible and noisy critics of our new free society we had been dreaming of having for decades. We who are here today know that the market, free market system does not reward most, neither the best nor the brightest, but those who, in whatever form and way, satisfy the tastes and preferences of others. And we know that the free market system does not typically reward those who are, in their own eyes, the most meritorious, because otherwise the market should reward all of us who are here more than anyone else in the world. And the markets value the intellectuals directly in their own eyes, and in addition to it, markets function nicely without their supervision. That's another reason why they are in favor of socialism. These arguments are definitely not new, but I must say that our experience in the first days after our so-called Velvet Revolution was a disrespect more than instructive. What actually happened was more textbook-like than any one of us would have expected. As our president, Victoria Courson Price, mentioned yesterday evening, in the first decade of the 21st century, we should not concentrate exclusively on socialism. We shouldn't fight the old, already non-existent battles. I do not want to say that socialism is definitely over. Probably we can confidently say that its hard version, communism, is over. This is a great victory for us, but this victory should not demotivate us, because the fall of communism doesn't automatically lead to a system we would like to have and live in. It is not the victory of ideas of classical or European liberalism. 15 years after the collapse of communism, and probably more than at the beginning, I am afraid of its softer or weaker version of social democratism, which has become, under different names, welfare state or soziale Marktwirtschaft, the German-speaking people here, has become the dominant model of the economic and social system of current Western civilization. It's based on big and patronizing government, on extensive regulating of human behavior, and on large-scale income redistribution. As we can see both in Europe and in America, the intellectuals love such a system. It gives them money and an easy life. It gives them an opportunity to be influential and to be heard. The Western world is still affluent enough to be able to support and finance many of their unpractical and directly unpurposeful activities. It can afford the luxury of employing them to use poetry for praising the existing system, for selling the concept of positive rights, for advocating constructivist human designs instead of spontaneous human action, for promoting other values than freedom and liberty. I would like to add one point. After the complete disregarding of communism and in the moment of the undeniable crisis of the European social democratism, the explicit socialism has become insufficiently attractive for most intellectuals. It's difficult to find nowadays in the West an intellectual who wants to be in, to have an influence, who would call himself a socialist. The explicit socialism has lost its appeal, and we should not have it as the main rival to our ideas today. Illiberal ideas are becoming to be formulated, spread, and preached under the name of ideologies or isms which have, at least formally and nominally, nothing in common with the old-style explicit socialism. These ideas are, however, in many respects similar to it. There is always a limiting of human freedom, there is always ambitious social engineering, there is always an immodest enforcement of a good by those who are anointed on others against their will. There is always the crowding out of standard democratic procedures by democratic methods, by alternative political procedures, and there is always the fearing of superiority of intellectuals and of their ambitions. I have in mind environmentalism, radical human rightism, ideology of civic society, multiculturalism, feminism, a political technocratism, internationalism, and especially its European variant I call Europeanism, and a rapidly growing phenomenon I call NGOism. All of them represent substitute ideologies for socialism. All of them give intellectuals new possibilities, new space for their activities, new niches in the market of ideas. To face these new isms, to reveal their true nature, and to be able to get rid of them, maybe, as Victoria mentioned last night, maybe more difficult than in the past. It may be more complicated than fighting old explicit socialism. These alternative ideologies, in their unclear, unstable, and yet undescribed potential synergy, are successful, especially where there is no sufficient resistance to them, where they find a fertile soil for their flourishing, where they find a country or the whole continent where freedom and free markets have been heavily undermined by long-lasting collectivistic dreams and experiences, and where intellectuals have succeeded in getting and maintaining a very strong voice and social status. I have in mind, of course, rather Europe than America. It is Europe where we witness the crowding out of democracy by post-democracy, where the EU dominance replaces democratic arrangements in the individual member countries, where the Hayek's para-government connected with organized, because organizable interests successful in guiding policy, and where even some of the liberals, in their justified criticism of the state, do not see the dangers of empty Europeanism and of a deep and ever deeper but only bureaucratic unification of the whole European continent. They applaud the growing formal opening of the continent, but do not see that the elimination of some of the borders without actual liberalization of human activities only shifts governments upwards, which means to the level where there is no democratic accountability and where the decisions are made by politicians, appointed by politicians, not elected by citizens in free elections. The European Constitution was an attempt to set up and to consolidate such a system in a legal form. It was an attempt to constitute it. It is hence more than important that the French and Dutch referenda made an end to it, that they interrupted the seemingly irreversible process toward ever closer Europe, and that they set into motion, in Eurospeak, a reflection period. I do not think that this permitted reflection, organized from above, will go far enough to reveal deeply rooted causes of the current European problems. It nevertheless opened the door, and we should use this opportunity for reminding, and this is the task of this society, for reminding our fellow citizens what makes our society free, democratic, and prosperous. Now, I have a list of what makes it, but you know it, I suppose. So, I would like to end by saying that the founding fathers of the Mondlerian society, Hayek, Friedman, and some of those who are still here with us, always insisted on fighting for what seemed politically impossible. I believe we should keep doing the same. Thank you very much.